Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, Pope Benedict prays for the victims of a devastating earthquake in central Italy. Looking ahead to the Pope's May visit to the Holy Land this Easter week, we go to two Jerusalem sites associated with the Lord's Passion. And we hear how Peter's denial of Christ has been depicted by artists through the centuries. Pope Benedict XVI has sent a telegram to Archbishop Molinari of Aquila, Italy, expressing his sorrow and solidarity with the people of Abruzzo following Monday night's devastating earthquake. The quake struck 70 miles northeast of Rome near the medieval city of Aquila. Some 200 people have died and thousands injured in the quake, but the toll is destined to rise as rescue workers race to find people still trapped beneath the rubble. In his telegram, the Pope expresses his heartfelt participation in the suffering of the beloved people affected by the tragic quake. He also gives assurances of his fervent prayers for the victims, especially the children, asking the Lord to bring comfort to their families, and while giving affectionate words of encouragement to the survivors and the people who, in various ways, are helping in the rescue operations, he sent everyone his special apostolic blessing. Lydia O'Kane has been following the news for us. She filed this report.
While Italian residents in central Italy slept, the earthquake struck in the early hours of Monday morning, leaving a trail of destruction in its wake. Measuring 6.3 on the Richter scale, its epicenter was in the region of Abruzzo, east of Rome, and it was also felt in the Italian capital 110 kilometers away. Its power caused entire blocks of buildings to collapse, leaving dozens of people dead and others trapped under rubble. The most hard-hit area of the Abruzzo region was the 13th-century city of Aquila, which is home to around 70,000 inhabitants. The Archbishop of Aquila, Giuseppe Molinari, on Monday urged people to follow the directives given by the Civil Protection Authority for their own security and said that this was also a time for people to have faith in the Lord. The last major quake to hit central Italy was a 5.4 magnitude tremor that struck the south-central Molise region on October the 31st, 2002, killing 28 people, including 27 children who died when their school collapsed. The country's civil protection authorities say that the quake may have left tens of thousands of people homeless, and it's also feared that the death toll from this disaster will rise further. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Dr. David Booth, seismologist for the British Geological Survey, says further precautions should be taken for continuing aftershocks, which are rocking the region.
Italy is known to be very seismic, and such earthquakes will occur from time to time. And such earthquakes almost invariably cause aftershocks. And these aftershocks can cause damage because buildings have already been weakened. And even though the earthquakes tend to be smaller than the main shock, they can cause damage because the buildings are weaker. I can't also promise that the next event, when it occurs, which may be weeks, it may be years, it may be of the same size as the present one. There is a history of earthquakes which have been of similar magnitude, and in fact in 1997 the earthquake sequence there included about 8 earthquakes greater than magnitude 5 over 2 months, so that aftershock activity should be expected and precautions should be taken against further damage.
Dr. David Booth is a seismologist for the British Geological Survey. It's on the hillside opposite the ancient stone walls of Jerusalem, commanding a sweeping view of the valley below. It's the small olive grove where Christ prayed to be delivered from the terrible destiny that was soon to befall him. But Christ, who humbly accepted his fate, was to endure his torment in solitude. His three disciples had fallen asleep nearby.
Oh,
Well, since the 4th century, the faithful have included the Garden of Olives, or Gethsemane, in their pilgrimages to the places of the Lord's Passion. Today, pilgrims can stroll through the small grove and pray or stop to reflect on Christ's last hours among the gnarled, wizened olive trees shading the garden paths. In the early 20th century, the Franciscans, with the financial help of many nations, built a new basilica over the ruins of a 4th century church and the rubble of a Byzantine shrine. The faithful can also visit the Grotto of the Betrayal, the place where for centuries local Christians have believed Christ was betrayed by Judas. As part of our series of Lenten reflections on Christian sites in the Holy Land, scholar and author Father Peter Stravinskas takes us up the hill to the Garden of Gethsemane, recalling the agony of that night.
The site is a most impressive, appealing one, even today. One finds in the garden surrounding the Church of All Nations massive olive trees, and botanists are able to say, yeah, as a matter of fact, one or two of those are 2,000 years old.
So they would have been there.
They would have been witnesses, living witnesses to the Lord's agony in the garden. And if one goes from the cenacle down to the Garden of Olives, St. John tells us in his gospel that Jesus went through the Kidron Valley and he passed over the Kidron Stream. And we're thinking, why mention that little piece of geography? Who cares? They had to cross a stream. Well, as a matter of fact, as the sacrifices were being immolated at the temple in preparation for the Passover, that stream, there was a channel or a canal, if you will, from the site of the sacrifices of the lambs. So the blood went down into that stream.
So this is during Passover.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And when John tells us that Jesus passed over the Kidron Stream, one can see that he can look into that stream and see the blood of the lambs.
And that's another passing over.
Exactly. Another passing over. He passes over that. And as a matter of fact, all of the blood that's going down in that stream that night is going to be fulfilled in his shedding of his blood the next day. So it's a marvelous piece of information. John is not only just a great theologian, but he's an incredibly sensitive and subtle writer. And you get these little tidbits which seem like, oh, cute, clever, interesting piece of information. But as a matter of fact, if you look a little deeper, you find that there's a profound theological truth that he's trying to convey there. At any rate, once again, that inner circle, Peter, James, and John, that are with Jesus on the Mount of the Transfiguration, that are with him for the raising of the daughter of Jairus, are now with him in the Garden of Gethsemane. And what do? They sleep. And St. Thomas More has a wonderful book called The Sadness of Christ, which he wrote while he was in the Tower of London. And it's an extended meditation on the agony in the garden. And he makes a somewhat cynical but telling comment. He says, in England at this moment, there are people claiming that the bishops are not the successors of the apostles. And he said, and that is completely false, and it's proven by this agony in the garden. He says, Peter, James, and John, among the first bishops in the church, as a matter of fact, slept through our Lord's most pitiful moment. He said, just as the bishops in England today are sleeping while the persecution of the church is going on. Of course, he's referring to the fact that only one bishop in England refused to sign the oath of supremacy, St. John Fisher, who was martyred as a result, and the papal nuncio. All the other bishops collaborated. And the message isn't simply about bishops being unfaithful to Christ. It's, as a matter of fact, Christians historically do exactly the same thing. We are asleep at the switch. Instead of identifying with Christ in his passion, we prefer to do other things, whether that's physical sleep or all kinds of distracting activities, so that we get our mind off something as annoying as following a suffering Christ.
Gethsemane was also the site where, of course, Jesus was betrayed by a kiss.
That's right. And that shows the depth of the malevolence, to use a symbol of friendship to betray. Many spiritual writers throughout the centuries have made the observation that what made our Lord sweat the drops of blood, which of course there is good medical evidence that that can indeed happen, was not the prospect of the physical suffering, but that he was able, in his intense humanity and at the same time joined to his divine person, able to see the betrayal of Judas, the denial of Peter, but also the disunity in his church throughout history. And this is what weighed on his sacred heart and on his mind more than anything else. And this is what caused this intense suffering and the agony in the garden. So that, as a matter of fact, and seeing the sins of the world until the end of time, not so much the crucifixion, that would have been over within a few hours, but that the agony of Christ continues, we can say, through the sins that are committed day in and day out by you and by me.
They seized Jesus and led him away and took him to the house of the high priest. Peter followed at a distance. A servant girl recognized him and said, "This man was with him." But Peter denied it. A little later, someone else saw him and said, "You are also one of them." "Man, I am not," Peter replied. About an hour later, yet another person exclaimed, "Certainly this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean." And again Peter replied, "I do not know what you are talking about." Just as he uttered those words, the rooster crowed. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. And Peter remembered what the Lord had said to him, "Before the rooster crows today, you will disown me three times." And he went outside and wept bitterly.
Peter's betrayal of Christ is an important part of the Lord's Passion and was remembered by the earliest Christians in Jerusalem. Today, the Church of St. Peter of Gallicantu, Latin for "the place where the cock crowed," stands on the slopes of Jerusalem's Mount Zion, on the site where Jesus was believed to have been imprisoned by the high priest Caiaphas. Though the actual church dates from 1931, built by the Assumptionist Fathers, it was constructed over the ruins of a 5th century shrine and rises above a series of crypts and chambers carved out of rock in the very first few decades after Christ's crucifixion.
In Gallicantu means "at cock's crow." And we recall that our Lord predicted that Peter would deny him three times before the cock crows. And this church, as a matter of fact, commemorates that event. If you look at the Porta Santa in St. Peter's Basilica, the door used for access during Jubilee years, during Holy Years, there is one frame that is the conversion of Peter, it's called, the Conversio Petri, the turning of Peter. And St. Luke does this in a very touching manner. He says that at Peter's betrayal, he turned and he saw the face of Christ and wept. And it's the converting look. It's Peter turning, seeing Jesus, and in that instant realizing the terrible horror of what he had done. If we want to contrast the persons of Judas and Peter, both of them committed horrendous sins. But the difference, and both of them were intensely sorry. Judas's sorrow ends in an act of despair because it's not turned toward Christ. It's turned toward the self. I'm sorry for what I did, but I don't go to the right source to deal with the problem. So his ends in the despairing act of suicide. Peter's sorrow turns outward toward the only one who can help us really deal with guilt, and that's Christ. And, as a matter of fact, it's transformative. His sorrow is brought to a completion in a renewed relationship with Christ, which we find depicted at the site of Tabgha, where Jesus appears to Peter after the resurrection and commissions him to be the substitute shepherd, we can say, for the church. Now, people today at times have some unrealistic expectations of ecclesiastical leaders. While they themselves feel quite comfortable sinning on a regular basis and having access to the sacrament of penance whenever they want it, which is good, they somehow think that simply by virtue of sacramental ordination or episcopal consecration that a man loses his humanity or somehow he becomes subsumed into Christ's divinity. And they're uncomfortable with sinners leading the church. But what's fascinating about this is that, as a matter of fact, in that Easter commissioning of Peter to be the substitute shepherd, Jesus asks Peter, "Simon, Peter, do you love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." "Simon, Peter, do you love me more than these?" "Yeah, but..." And then even dumb Peter gets it. He was asking this three times. Could that be a reason? "Oh, I denied him three times." So yes, the triple denial is undone by a triple profession of love. But then there's something that's very interesting that follows. Precisely within the context of reminding Peter, painfully, one must imagine, of his horrific sin, Jesus then commissions him to be the rock of the church. "Feed my lambs, feed my sheep." Jesus is not uncomfortable in having imperfect ministers run his church. Now, that's not to say, fine, then go sin all you want as a priest or a bishop or anything else. But it is important to appreciate the fact that one's personal sinfulness does not impede one from, as a matter of fact, doing the pastoral work of the church. Admittedly, the goal must always be that there's a complete as possible, as humanly possible, consonance between one's personal life and one's public vocation. But at the same time, it's just good to put this in a little bit of perspective. And again, to go back to this healing look of Jesus that's able to convert all of us, and all of us, as a matter of fact, are in need of daily reconversion. Conversion is not a one-shot deal. This is one of the mistakes made so often by fundamentalists, that I gave my life over to Jesus 20 years ago, I said the sinner's prayer, and everything is hunky-dory since then. It's not. It's Jesus tells us in Luke's gospel that we must carry our cross daily. Luke adds the word daily. And if it's a daily carrying the cross, it's also a daily asking for the grace to be able to carry the cross, and a daily asking for forgiveness when we fail to do that.
And a warm thanks there to Father Peter Stravinskas, a noted scholar and author and editor of the Catholic Response.
Thank you.
Imagine if we were haunted by an image that would always be there to remind us of our human failings, or worse, of our greatest failure. It is unlikely that after Christ's crucifixion, that St. Peter was ever able to look at a rooster again without his heart breaking. Christian art historian Elizabeth Lev told me the rooster is a protagonist of depictions in paintings and frescoes here in Rome of the story of Peter's denial of Christ.
If ever there was a story that found its way to Rome and found a home here, it would be the story of the denial of Peter, because of course Peter ends up here and he is of course the head of the church. And so it's kind of a funny little start, you know, this guy who denies Jesus three times, and then at the end, you know, he's our first pope. He's the one who's, you know, will be the one that the rock is built upon. So, you know, from this very inauspicious moment, he did become the rock that is still the support and the foundation of St. Peter's today. And one of the things, I mean, right off the bat, St. Peter's as a church has never dodged that bullet, if you will. It's never denied the mistakes of Peter and Peter's trust, however, in Jesus and God to forgive him, to put him back on the right track. And in the first church of St. Peter's, the one that was built by Constantine, the one that was, you know, until 1506, the magnificent church. One of the very famous objects in that church was a little bronze effigy of a rooster. And there was you can still see it today in the Treasury Museum of St. Peter's. It's a little bronze rooster, which apparently was out there in one of the inner atriums. And according to sort of the medieval tour guides, who were very good at coming up with great stories, it contained the remains of the actual cock that crowed that morning, which is one of those relics you might want to take with a grain of salt. But the fact of the matter is, the fact of the matter is that it did kind of tell you before you even walked into St. Peter's, it reminded you that he started from, you know, what we would all consider a pretty serious sin, and yet, you know, pulled himself together and it became the rock underneath St. Peter's. So it's a wonderful story about how we can all follow suit, pick ourselves up. And some of the most beautiful paintings in this city and around the world, really, are the images of Peter after he's denied Christ. This is very popular in Spanish painting, particularly, where they have the moment of Peter. They represent Peter alone in tears, crying, and yet this usually a light is coming in, comforting him, showing him that, you know, don't give up, don't make the mistake that Judas made of not realizing that you can be forgiven. So it's a very, very important part. And inside the church, in the decoration that was done from 1600 on, inside St. Peter's, when people walk in, you know, you look above the big arches and the little figures of the virtues, and people see lining all the way around the inside of the nave of St. Peter's these big black letters. They're 6 foot tall black letters on a golden ground. Everybody always wants to have written in Latin, except for one little section written in Greek. What does that say? And I always think of it as Peter's job description, because it's everything that Jesus said to Peter, but particularly important is the three times it's repeated in those letters, the three times that Jesus asks Peter, "Do you love me?" For the three times he denied, so you start out with the rooster and the reminder of the three-time denial. You walk into the church and the nave is decorated with the three-time response, "Yes, I love you, yes, I love you, yes, I love you." So it's a very nice counterbalance.
But the rooster also appears in other artwork, I think. I'm thinking of the Palazzo Colonna right off Piazza Venezia in the center of town. I remember going in there recently and seeing someone I was with pointed out, why is there a rooster in this painting on this fresco on the wall? But it didn't seem to be a particularly religious theme, if I recall correctly. But it does transcend this idea of just simply religious scenes. It also is used, the rooster, to bring us back to the theme of denials
and of betrayal. Exactly. The rooster theme has, it's one of those that has the that okay from the earliest Christian representations. There are marble sarcophagi, numerous marble sarcophagi from the 4th century, which have the representation of Peter. Peter always has his little rooster carved into the sarcophagus. So it's not an unusual thing. It's very, very common in popular imagery, that constant reminder of Peter's error. What's interesting is the way that it's really brought out in Rome so much, in a city where, you know, they've lived with the papacy for 2,000 years. And you know, those of us who live here know that the Romans have had sort of good moments and bad moments living with their papacy. And so that sort of constant representation of the rooster is, again, that kind of reminder of the Romans who are very, they not all the Romans, but there's a certain little contingent of Romans who have always been very quick to criticize the papacy. As a matter of fact, the Palazzo Colonna that you're talking about is right near the Campidoglio, which is the ancient center of Republican Rome. And throughout the Middle Ages, when the Pope traveled in the papal procession from Rome to St. John Lateran, when he had to pass around the Campidoglio, that's where all the Roman Republicans were. That's where all the people who wanted Rome to be a free republic would be. And they would throw stones. It was like a gauntlet the Pope had to pass through of these people who were very anti-papal. So, you know, it's that you know, a rooster's going to show up in the art here is not at all surprising.
Hang on, was there a story once that the cannonball, I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous.
No, this is cannonball. There's a famous, famous story about Queen Christine of Sweden, our most famous convert of the 17th century. She's also our most colorful convert of the 17th century. So she arrived in Rome in 1655 dressed as an Amazon, which I think took Alexander VII somewhat by surprise. And she was apparently in the Castel Sant'Angelo and persuaded some very ill-advised custodian of the papal fort, which is Castel Sant'Angelo, which used to have cannonballs and cannons at the ready, to let her fire a cannonball, which I thought perhaps they thought was just going to go into the river, but it actually ended up in the staircase of the Colonna Palace. And
the Colonna to this day, you can actually see the dent.
The Colonna's with a magnificent sense of humor have left it there to this. They left the cannonball in the stair to this day.
Just getting back quickly to the icon of the rooster. I mean, it has even come down to this very day where you see the black, il gallo nero, on the dock Italian wines, the quality Italian wines. Don't you see that?
Oh, that's right. Yes, of course. I wonder, does that mean we're supposed to worry about the high quality Italian wines?
Are we being betrayed?
Are we being betrayed?
Well, we'll have to look into the real story behind the Black Rooster on Italy's quality wine bottles, but that's another program. In the meantime, I'd like to thank Elizabeth Lev, Professor of Christian Art and Architecture at Duquesne University's Rome campus. For now, I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening. That concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.